CliffCentral.com.
All right. Good morning, everybody. It's Tuesday. It is the 28th of July, and we are live. It is just after 7. Lots of things to get into, plenty to talk about. Reasons for us, as Pumi said at the start of the show this morning, to be angry already or both, but also lots of other reasons for us to get together and talk every morning. I'm going to start this hour with an unprecedented second compliment for Mbulelo on the emails.
Now you're trolling me. Now you're just trolling me.
I hope everyone is staying sane throughout the smoking and limited drinking. This is from Julie. Okay, sorry, not Julie, James. James says, just wanted to say Mbulelo has added such a fantastic element to the show. He's really good at explaining his point of view and dumbing it down for us accountants. I love hearing his point of view, and I think he is a great addition to the team. I thought I would share this as I would like to let you know when I didn't like someone, so I must give compliments when I do. That's me acting like I'm the CEO. Anyway, stay safe and carry on doing what you're doing, keeping me sane with all this craziness going on. Thank you, James. All right. Very nice.
Very nice.
Very nice indeed. You can get hold of us, and you can send us your messages on 079-748-2090.
So, I just want to tell James,
yes.
I'm dumbing it down for me. It's because I have to bring it down to my level.
You don't protest too much.
Just take it and run.
Casey wants to say, in response to our conversation about all these love affairs between white and black and colored people that used to be under the radar, he says, being a colored sucks. Casey is a colored. In the old apartheid, we weren't white enough, and now in the racist BEE times, we're not black enough. Many of us truly believe we had a better time under apartheid than with the delinquent government we have now. Yeah, I've heard this from people. One of my colored friends says that actually he's found like colored people can be more racist than almost anyone else. But that's exactly the sort of generalization that doesn't apply, you know. That's just your experience. But I do hear it. I mean, I hear this. And it must be frustrating. You're not white enough with these irks, then you're not black enough with these irks.
Mm.
Horrible.
Nor does it help anything. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw a judge outside the courtyard smoking a cigarette before heading in. Is that not basically illegal? That's from Elroy, who actually saw a judge doing that. Yeah, it is illegal.
It's not illegal to be smoking, guys.
Yeah, but you're telling me he's had that cigarette since March?
Yeah, where would he have
stuck
got
in
it?
His robes?
Maybe the man was prepared. He was always ready.
Okay.
I saw someone yesterday, and because I have to go out for a meeting today, so I went last night just thinking about it, going, oh, I need to go and fill up my car. So went out to fill my car up, and already it was like 8 p.m. And being a goody two shoes that I am, I was so nervous going, what if I'm still on the road? Yes, at 9. I saw the definition of not giving a damn. A man just walking casually. You could tell he was nowhere close to being where he needs to be.
Puffing
away at a cigarette. I'm thinking, my guy, you're the man.
You're my fighter.
You're the one.
I had forgotten about the curfew. And it was my dad's birthday. Mm-hmm. So Kanego and I took him a cake. We took a cake over to him. And Kanego said to me, Mommy, we've got to be back home. You know, there's a curfew. We've got to be back home by 9 o'clock. I was like, what are you talking about? But
so did you go back before? You made it before?
Yeah, we were never going to stay. We were actually doing a bit of a drive-by. We were driving by to drop off cake and stuff. And we're just driving by. Hello, old folks. Also, you know, don't want to hang out too much with the old people.
Has Kanego seen a lot of his grandparents during lockdown?
No. Kanego is very compliant. I don't know where he gets it.
Not from you and not from his father.
He is, oh my goodness, he has been such a stickler to all of the stuff. He goes to school and comes home. He doesn't want to go anywhere. Even going for the drive-by at my parents was a thing. He was like, Mommy, I wasn't going to see people come over. He's quite very, very compliant. So we have not seen a lot of grandparents. We've done some video calls, but it's difficult because all his grandparents are in Soweto. And with all of the power outages, the first thing that goes are the cell towers, and there's not enough. So it's also the bandwidth is not great. And yeah, they really are old people. So it's hard. Like the video calling is a real struggle.
I got this.
He also hasn't seen his dad much. He refused to go to his dad. He felt his dad wasn't being compliant. So
Was
just like, I'm not going to that guy's house. I'm not going to that guy's house until after the lockdown. Mommy, there's a high chance of somebody getting COVID over there.
People he is large and in charge, man.
He was very focused. He was just like, I'm not going back there. And this was in June, actually, that he said, I'm not going back to that guy's house. People come over there. There's a high chance of getting COVID. And I was like, it's going to be Father's Day. Aren't you going to go? He's like, especially not on Father's Day. Then people are going to like want to have a braai. No, I'm not going.
Sure, he's very compliant. This is good.
I don't know where he gets it from.
you want to shake some rebellion into him.
I know, I do. I'm reading John Lewis's book. We found a book you were talking about in Sia on all these new books that we're reading. And I try and read lots of books that have like black boys stories. Mm-hmm. So that story was, and there's a lot of books that are made for children, preteens, that we found on Amazon. So that's what we're reading. I'm just like, young man, see what life could be like.
Yeah
man. Look, that's the... With his passing, with Congressman John Lewis's passing, I've just been going back, and yes, you know, certain things you know about or you vaguely remember from history at school, but when you actively take it in as an adult, I feel like it makes a huge difference. And to hear about what that generation did, I was particularly drawn into the story of the Freedom Riders.
Mm-hmm.
And these were young kids who were protesting. And for me, what particularly stunned me was that they were younger than me, even. They were 18, 19, 20, 21, getting onto these buses and stopping at these small towns and protesting segregation and dining at whites-only restaurants. And, dude.
And getting the shit kicked out of them and beaten every month and thrown into jail. And the next morning, get on a bus.
Carry on. Yeah, yeah.
To the next town and do it all over again.
Dude.
Yeah. This, you know what? I do like the fact that we've got a bit of time during this craziness to catch up on some of these stories, because there are lots of them and there's some great books out at the moment. So I've been doing a bit of reading, which I'm pleased with.
It was a very beautiful ceremony, because Congressman John Lewis was... had his funeral yesterday, so I was live streaming some of it, and I was following the hearse as it was driving around DC, and it was very beautiful.
Well, apparently there are people who's listen to this quickly. Morning, guys. I'm listening for the first time since lockdown. I missed the No More Bullshit intro and had to do a little dance when it started. Does Mbulelo still live at the office? How is sunlight in Sia's office in winter? And can you dry your underpants?
I no longer live in the office. No.
And while we're talking about living arrangements, this comes from Elaine. She says, I'm an introvert myself, but I'm starting to miss certain things. My study is now the gym. The dining room is the office. Soon I will be sleeping in the bathroom. Yeah.
Just to keep it fresh.
Yeah. Here's a good point that's being made by Rochelle. Rochelle says, there's no electricity, no alcohol, no cigarettes, no travel. South Africa is pretty much like an Amish state. You know, the Amish are those people in America who live without electricity. They kind of live in the 1800s.
No, they live further back than that. In Utah, exposed to them for the first time for me in Utah. Incredible way to live, by the way. Wow.
No, I wouldn't want to live like that. They use tools like old-ass tools from the 1800s as well. They don't use power drills and like, you know, modern hammers. They use like old mallets made of wood and band saws that two people have to operate. Those kinds of things, right?
For starters, but do you want to hear the saucier side of what happens to their children? I mean, the Amish and...
That 1 year gap is amazing.
What's that?
Oh, go ahead. Okay, because I experienced it for real, but Paul seems to have a story.
So what is unbelievably fascinating about them is that when they turn 19 or something,
correct,
they get to leave. The kids get to leave their Amish home. They obviously go in pairs or whatever. You don't go alone. You there's three or four of you together at a time. No, it's not to be chaperoned. It's just so that you're not completely alone, but you get to go out into the world. Mm-hmm. For a year. To live wild. What is that thing?
Correct.
And just live it out. And have it. And the debauchery and the drinking and the.
Oh, really?
Correct.
No limit. Mm-hmm. No limit. But the thing that gets my noodle every time is how many of those kids go back? Then you get a choice. You can go back or you can just leave the community forever. You can feel that, oh my God, this new outside life is amazing and never go back. Mm. But how many people choose to go back to that madness?
That was my first question. I think that because it's almost like a purge year for them, and I met them in particular when I was working in ski resorts, and as you say, they go out as crews. If you want to have a good time, there is nothing like catching Amish Mormon people in that release year.
Yeah.
Modimo.
Are they out of control?
You don't know a good time until you've done it with. Yeah. And I had. Oh, wow. So the big season I did was in Canada, and we had like a whole crew of them living in this one house. And we knew if it was time to have a proper party, we know where to go. Because every day it was insane how these guys were living, and girls. Just insane. Yeah. So.
I remember TLC at a point were running seasons and seasons and seasons of their reality show around them. I think it was called like Return to Amish. And that was specifically people who had been on the outside and they want to go back home. But the one scene that just still is so sad yet so pure in my mind is of a young Amish man who was tasting soda for the first time.
Oh, wow.
And he first had to inspect the can, and he had been told so much about this. You could tell that was the hesitation of like, you know, I have never had this, and so much has been said about it. And then he so excitedly opened it up, and he took his first sip, and he looked like a little child who had, you know, gotten his ideal gift for Christmas. And I thought, my guy, it's just, you know, a can of soda. Come on.
So if you want to meet them in abundance, Park City is the ski resort to go to, by the way, because that's obviously in Utah and it is nuts.
Mulelo, don't make it sound like they're a spectacle and like zoo animals.
Well, that's what he's saying.
No.
They are zoo animals.
Yes, if I'm not being clear, that is exactly what I'm saying. It is an experience like Disney World.
So, go and find them. Go and catch them all.
Persecute me if you will, but it is. Oh man, some of my favorite people. Just that year was, oh wow. Those stories I can't tell. I don't mind telling you about Camps Bay, but the stories.
You're holding out on us, man.
Oh man, that they are something else. Good people.
Sure.
Good.
I heard, is this true that you know, there was that church in Centurion where people were, they were busy praying, and then these three brigands broke in and they tried to rob the place, and a guy shot them. I think it was Joost van der Westhuizen's brother.
Joost van der Westhuizen's
brother. So apparently that the congregation, after they'd been shot, they started praying for them.
Oh, Pastor Quibus Erasmus.
Laying hands on them. What?
Yeah.
They praying
laying
for them.
Hands on them.
Prayed for the criminals, because, I mean, this is so horrible. I'm thinking, well, they were about to harm you here. I'm all for praying, but I don't see this being fit. So anyway, Pastor Quibus Erasmus has spoken out. He is the pastor at the church, and he has told exactly what happened when these criminals came and disrupted the Sunday service. So he said they were singing the last hymn, and he was just about to say the last prayer. He says that we were shocked beyond words because we were in the church, and within seconds, everything changed. The men came in with loaded firearms. One of the gunmen hit me with the front of the gun on the head, gangster style. These are his words. I also don't know what gangster style means, but let's go with his quote.
Like on TV when you watch
I'm not laughing, sorry, it's a horrible thing. He continues to say, he told me to lie down, but I could not because I have a broken hip. Yet, then he took my cell phone. The men also took cell phones and jewelry from the congregants, and the items were later recovered, thankfully. But after he was hit on the head, the pastor said there was an exchange of gunshots. It's difficult to tell you because it was all just a blur in his words. But that's when, thankfully, Peter van der Westhuizen retaliated. And that's when the pastor saw two of the criminals just fall to the ground, and that's when he just called in the congregation to start praying for these guys who had fallen, because clearly something had happened. He, of course, now it's been revealed that they were shot, so then they just started praying for them.
And well, that's good. That's what good Christians would do.
That's wonderful. I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, so they shot them, but they still felt that they were, you know, people who deserved a prayer on their way out.
Okay.
Kind of like the indigenous Americans who pray for the animal after they've killed it.
Yeah, that's
like
exactly what they do, yeah.
I see what you're saying. You send it off to pasture in peace. Well, see, just before you carry on, what happens if those people go to hell? Then you've prayed for someone in hell. Now there's a confusion with admin in hell. What's the story there?
No, I think God is still in charge in that department.
Oh, okay.
You don't get to make up those rules.
Oh,
all right. You are starting things this morning.
God still has a decision-making power about hell. Yeah.
Okay.
No amount of prayer can change that.
Oh, all right.
The pastor said that it was a hard and sore thing to pray for these criminals, but regardless, he did. And then to answer any questions around Peter van der Westhuizen's involvement in all of this, well, Peter's an ex-policeman and allegedly produced his own firearm, and shots were fired then. Police told media on Sunday.
And obviously a member of the congregation.
Yes, and that's why he was there. Police told media on Sunday that the two suspected robbers were shot dead, and according to the pastor, there were about 19 shots fired in total. He's also said that the congregants who were in attendance have now gone for counseling, and one of the congregants said that the incident left her extremely traumatized. She said that she sits at the back of the church because she's in charge of the sound, and so when we were singing, I saw the door behind me open. I saw a guy with a gun, and he signaled that I should get down. I went on my knees and I started to pray.
Amen.
Wow. Hell of an exciting church.
Have you guys seen The Good Place, speaking of hell?
The Good Place?
Yeah.
Is this a TV show?
On Netflix. So underrated.
Oh, I thought, I'm only going there once I'm dead.
Because that could also be a church.
Yeah.
The Good Place could be...
I'm interested in.
Underrated, y'all. Watch it. Let's circle back and have this conversation again.
I'm fascinated at the hubris of criminals who take it for granted that they're going to be the only ones with guns in a room. There are a lot of people in this country who own guns and they know how to use them. If I were a criminal, I'd be a little more circumspect.
So is it hubris or is it simply taking the chance? Isn't it like the occupational hazard that you take as a criminal?
We've got to remember a lot of these criminals are not that proficient with firearms themselves. Some of them may be using them for the first time, you know?
Occupational hazard.
Yeah.
You bring your gun out, you could get shot, you could shoot someone.
Right. By no means am I saying I feel sympathy for these guys. I mean, you try to rob people in a church, you deserve to be taken out.
I think that that's the thing to worry about is that churches seem to be getting targeted more and more. There was the church in Zirbogom a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, they targeted themselves, so.
But still, yo, there was like people held hostage.
Yeah, that was a big story.
What I don't get is how did it take this long for churches to become the places you target is... That's the place with money. Like, we've known this since time immemorial, especially in the cash times. Ben Lindin.
It hasn't taken that long. The Vikings knew when they got off their
ship. Yeah, they certainly did.
When they raided the coast of Normandy, they knew they were going to get some serious booty of two kinds when they came to the monasteries and the churches. That was where the real riches were.
They said,
"Are you okay there?"
My favorite,
drowning in his coffee. That's double entendre around the booty.
It's happened. Oh, man.
If you do want to know about Peter van der Westhuizen, so far he hasn't spoken out, but his lawyer Ulrich Ruh has spoken out and said that his client was traumatized by the incident, saying that he acted in self-defense, not only for himself, but for the people who were in church. Uh-huh. He said that his client had spoken to the police about the incident, and so far he has not been charged. And a police spokesperson obtained a statement that was, got a statement from Peter van der Westhuizen and said that a statement has been obtained from the congregants who allegedly shot the suspects, and this will be submitted for some prosecution direction.
Well, I mean, are there people who would be not on his side in this case? Like, he's defending his own congregation. Is there an argument that we're missing here that could be he did the wrong thing? I don't see it.
Mm-mm.
With what we know so far, I don't think so.
I mean, I think this is a cut and dried case of self-defense. It seems to me fairly obvious what happened here. And, you know, he's got witnesses, hasn't he? He's got, like, the whole congregation who didn't get shot. who will
and the law.
Yeah. Those criminals really chose a bad target with this church. Jesus.
So where are we headed now? Private security at churches?
Oh, there's some churches that already have them. I know lots of synagogues have them because... You know, there's a history of kind of anti-Semitic attacks in parts of the world, and so there are synagogues where you go and you've got security outside. And I don't see why churches don't have private security, or why they don't think about private security.
Yeah, they do. Like my mother's church in Pimville, they have got they've got security, they've got alarm system, and armed response, because they've been hit. They've had break-ins on a number of occasions.
Mm. Imagine having to go through like a metal detector when you're about to go into church.
Oh, hell yes. This happens here. This is a serious thing.
See, there are schools in America where the kids have to go through metal detectors. Kids in school.
Yeah.
Primary school. So where they're adults, I'm sure you can have the same kind of measures.
And
this
I think
is the problem with the world, humans.
And I think it's only fair, because to get into the Vatican is almost like getting into North or out of North Korea. So fair enough. Fair enough that everyone gets a taste.
What do you mean, Buddha?
Listen, getting in there was the most interrogated. And I told you when I was in the Ukraine what happened to me at the airport. The most interrogated I've ever been was going into the Vatican. So
really?
Let's spread the love.
Really?
As just a tourist?
Yeah, no, I mean, that was, listen, I've been in some interesting places. My God.
Mulelo, you must be a very suspicious looking
person.
Yes,
I agree with Pumi.
Myself, I had no such experience.
Pumi, I didn't tell you what I said to my mom. Maybe they heard what I said while we were in there.
What did you say?
That might be the thing.
Huh?
What did you say?
That might be.
I had some questions about a boat and two of every kind and things like that in the thing.
So you were being obnoxious, were you?
Yeah. Well,
I say you deserve it. You've been to some interesting places, so security got into your interesting places.
Okay. And the Pope himself sent an instruction, that guy, you don't let that guy.
Mm-hmm.
You search him, you check that guy out, he's dangerous.
Yeah, shame on you.
Very full of himself, that one.
No, but it's horrible that people can't even be, you know, what, no matter what you think, people can't even go to church anymore. Like, I'm not a fan, but my God.
That's a big deal. No,
why are people even in church? Like, congregating
thank you.
In large groups.
Why, there we go. I didn't want to ask that question to kind of put makeup over that tragically people died. Benenza, I thought we weren't gathering, with all due respect.
People are gathering, man.
Although I did see...
I drove on the highway on Sunday, and I saw people... In like, they were setting up briars and tents and things next to a dam on the way, you could see it from the highway. And there were cops on that highway. People
so what are
having
you saying,
a party, man.
You're saying Cyril's lost control?
Dude, right here at Albert's Farm, there's a little lake near my house. And, and there's large groups of congregating Christians, Africans at prayer on a Sunday.
Yeah, when they stand like that in the fields and you see them with their robes on.
And in fact, this past Sunday, I saw the largest group I've seen in a long time congregating over there. Obviously, these are scary times. People are seeking
solace
in spiritual places.
Sure. Yeah.
Amen to that.
Hallelujah.
Absolutely. And who the hell are we to judge? Mbulelo, you know, you're a devout heathen, so what do you know?
Yeah, well said. Well said. This is well,
my dad is not having the best of times at all.
How's his congregation?
Yeah, well, because he hasn't gone back to church this whole entire time. Oh, so this now means he has more spare time on his hands, which means we receive even more of his weekly, which have now been, you know, every 3 days, WhatsApp statements.
Oh, shame. Yeah, he's just about... trying to keep everybody informed.
So his flock has shrunk to just you guys. So yeah. Come on.
Yeah. And voice notes or video, Sia?
What's he doing? I've said it before on the show. My dad, you know, speaks like a politician, and it's always like a very well thought out statement. So yesterday, I actually ignored this because I thought this is not going anywhere. He said, "Good evening to your." He was talking to one of my sisters, so he says, "Good evening, Zandile, to your siblings and Zet." That's what he affectionately calls my mother. He says, "We're fine at home. Yes, trying to keep warm." Fire emoji, because now he's into emojis.
Oh, wow.
"Temperatures are low in Durban. How are you in Pietermaritzburg?" Then he asked all of us individually where we were. I thought, you know what? This conversation is never going to end. So I ignored that.
Shame,
it's still carrying on now, but not going to happen. And he's still counting the day, if anyone would like to know. It's day 124 of lockdown.
Oh, really? So he keeps a table, huh?
Every single day, and he wants to let us know in the WhatsApp group every day. I don't know what we do with that information.
Well, man.
I'm delighted that your dad is trying to keep everybody in the flock, and he's trying to communicate his love. I mean, this is the way. I mean, this is really great, Sia. You don't have to be such a bastard about it.
He's a good shepherd.
I'm not being a bastard about it, but I just think it's sad.
I think you're being a bastard. This is how people of that generation, this is a lot of love that he's sending out there into the world. Come on.
Agreed. Yeah, I agree with that.
Don't you think it's just so ungrateful, Mbulelo?
It's sickening to see, Sia, open yourself up to love, right? Be ready to be loved.
And Sia,
it's the purest form of love.
Do you know how many young men in this country would love to have a father who actually cared about them? Growing up,
Tell him, Gareth.
Yes, there's some guys who cry. They're crying now. They're listening to your story, crying because their dads never said that stuff to them.
You know what? Let me add you guys to this group.
I'll humor your dad. I'll be respectful. I'll give him respect and return that love. I mean, that's special, Sia. You spoiled.
With pleasure. Please do. I can't do it anymore. 25 years is too long.
All right. I hear you. Okay, well, we've got lots to do this morning, and one of the things we want to do is check back in on our Lift the Ban. You know, we've been talking about this for some time now. So let me give you the background quickly, because we'll be joined in a short while by Jabulani Tembe, who's working alongside SATA, that's the South African Tobacco Transformation Alliance, and he's the secretary of the Black Tobacco Farmers Association. Now, we may have been holding our breath when the president spoke last week. Still no change, obviously, around the tobacco ban. So we will continue to talk about Lift the Ban and have those conversations here, because there are very few places that tobacco companies can talk and that farmers, tobacco farmers like Jabulani can speak. You know, they're not allowed to advertise, right, Pumi? There are very strict rules around this. So where can they talk? Where can they have their stories told? And last week we spoke to Johnny Moloto, who is the... he's working alongside the South African Tobacco Transformation Alliance as well. He's the head of external affairs for the South African area at British American Tobacco. And this morning we're going to be joined by Jabulani, and we'll find out what the repercussions of this ban are from his perspective, because this is about people's lives. You know, we can all joke about how, and I know you wanted to ask, you can go ahead and ask me now if you want to, Mbulelo, about the way I feel about my parents smoking. I've been very honest about this throughout.
Well, not just smoking, before Jabulani joins us, not just the smoking part, is now not only are they smoking, not only is there COVID, now they are getting a substandard product. Maybe we can answer that before Jabulani chats up.
Right. Well, I think so that we can get a better signal going here. Hi, Jabulani. How are you?
I'm fine. And yourself?
Good. There's a lot of noise going on there. So we're just going to turn off our videos so that you can hear us properly.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us this morning. So Jabulani, you are the boss of the Black Tobacco Farmers Association. How are you guys doing with this ban? How is it affecting you?
It's affecting us very, very badly, because we've lost crop and we have lost jobs, and we also lost income for our families and our farmers as well. So it dent a lot to the farmers, especially because we are new in this business, and we are trying to grab, and we are trying to get more information, and we are still trying to invest more on the equipment. So it dents us a lot.
So Jabulani, where is your farm, and tell us how long you've been in business there, and what you grow.
Basically, I'm the general secretary of BTFA, and we are operating in 5 provinces. So I'm talking on behalf of the farmers as a whole, but I'm operating in KwaZulu-Natal, in northern part of KwaZulu-Natal.
Okay.
In Tabialingana, yes.
And your farm, you just grow tobacco?
Yes, I grow tobacco.
So how much of that that money that comes in from tobacco sales is now not coming to you? I mean, I'm trying to get an idea of the scale of this, and you might not want to talk about your own farm, but maybe you can talk about, in general, how demand has gone down, and what can you do? Because you can't exactly throw this stuff away, and you can't store it forever, hey?
Yes, currently we are storing it in our yards, but it's very, very difficult, you know, to store this thing, and we are not sure whether they will take it or not, and definitely we cannot sell it for now. So we are waiting and waiting, and yet we are now approaching August. By August, we'll have to start preparing for another crop, which is supposed to be planted by the first week of September. And we can't do that because we are not sure what's going to happen about it and about this ban. And we cannot employ people, you know. People will lay off everybody, so it's really affecting us.
Are your workers in danger of being laid off?
Exactly. You know, we...
Pumi, you want to ask something? Go ahead.
Yes, I do. So I want to put... I don't know anything about tobacco farming, and maybe if you can give us a little bit of an introduction. So how does it work? When do you plant? How long does it take for you to get your crop? And how much labor goes into the work behind, so that people can understand a little bit more of how many people are involved and exactly how intensive it is? You know, I think it's an opportunity for all of us to understand a little bit more of your world.
Thank you. Basically, the tobacco, we start preparing the planting around August, beginning of August, and we start planting on the first week of September. It takes 51 days, then we start harvesting. So you employ people when you start preparing for land, and when you start planting as well, you employ a lot of people then. And when you start weed control and applying of chemicals, each and every day there's an activity that you do when you do in tobacco. So per hectare, you employ like 6 people per hectare. So it depends on the number of hectares that you have. So if you got more than 10 hectares, which means you employ about 30 people, so 30 to 40 people. So there's a lot of people that get employed in the tobacco industry.
And do you typically then have offtake agreements for your crop that you're now having to store? Because obviously the people that are milling and making cigarettes use your crop for that.
Yes, we do have an agreement to take the crops, but the challenge is if they cannot sell it, where they are going to store it? Because their stock, I mean, their stores are always are also full, so they cannot keep it. So even if you have a contract, but the contract, as you say, if there is a ban, it's a ban for everybody. It's not that it's a ban for the people with whom we have a contract with. So that's the challenge. No, you cannot say take the
I think we may have lost connection.
Okay.
All right, Sia, will you try and get Jabulani back for us? Because I don't think he can hear us there. I went
sure,
to ask him. See, the big problem here, Pumi, is this is not an illegal business. It's not like he's growing cocaine. You know, and you're allowed to grow tobacco in South Africa. You're allowed to sell tobacco in South Africa. It's just because of lockdown that he's in this situation. And he says in a press release that he put out over the last couple of days, he said the black tobacco farmers pay tax and run a legitimate business. We are creating jobs in South Africa, but the government is oppressing us. I think that's true. You can't argue with that.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Apparently, the ban is having a big impact on farmers and their workers, obviously. It's obvious that whatever they have planted, they can't harvest or sell at the moment. And the reality is that people are unable to take part in the formal economy, but they're doing it through the informal economy. So people are smoking, even though there is a tobacco ban in South Africa. So, I mean, this is very, very upsetting. And the Black Tobacco Farmers Association of South Africa say that the government's continued cigarette ban supports criminals. Now, who can argue with that?
Mm.
And I mean, as I said to you, I was talking about how my parents have been trying to get cigarettes. And as Jabulani and the Black Tobacco Farmers Association have said, that all the cigarette ban has done is it's giving criminals an opening to come in and sell their stuff, which is illegal, and they're not paying tax on it. Jabulani, you back?
Yes, I'm back.
Sorry, Pumi was just asking you. She said this is the busiest time of year for you, and therefore this is actually the time where you need to be working the hardest and have the most people on your farms, right?
Yes, yes.
It's crazy. So how do you feel about the illegal trade of black market cigarettes, of you know, the cigarettes that are illicit?
Yeah, the illicit in South Africa, it's like they just open a can of worms because everybody is doing illicit in the air in the country. And it's like it's being authorized by the government because these people are allowed to do illicit and sell cigarettes. And most of the cigarette is not from the country, it's from outside the country. And it's coming inside the country and they're selling it at a very, very low. Every corner of the street, you'll get it. Everybody who smokes a cigarette in South Africa, it's smoking cigarette. And they're buying cigarettes from black market. And it's killing the business because we are paying tax and these people are not paying tax. Uh-huh. And the government is doing nothing about it.
So if you could say something to government, if the president and Nkosasana Dlamini Zuma and the rest of the NCCC were listening right now, what would you say to them?
I'll tell them that they must leave to the ban. Because we are losing jobs and we are losing income and we are creating an environment where people will keep on depending on social grants, and it's not fair. And you cannot keep on giving people 350 rands, whereas people are earning income for themselves and they're able to survive about that with that money. And you tell them that they'll give you social grants, so stop working, we'll give you social grants. It's not fair.
Yeah. Now, you know, the Black Tobacco Farmers Association, sorry, Pums, you've got 155 members, right? And these are all smallholder tobacco farms. You guys also grow some vegetable crops, and obviously many of you want to grow into large commercial farms, and you can't do that if the ban stays in place because you can't even sell the stuff that you currently have.
Yeah, basically we're negotiating with a lot of people to assist in terms of these farmers so that they can able to go commercial.
Oh.
And we're busy negotiating to get more land for farmers to get land so that they can grow tobacco. It's a pity that this industry was dominated by white commercial farmers.
Mm.
Now, we as black, we struggle to get to this industry. It wasn't easy.
Mm.
We had to fight so that we can able to get into this industry. Now we are in this industry, the government is switching off the industry. It's killing us. Where to go now?
And you know, because you guys are organized and we on the outside that are just single individuals often get told that, you know, being organized, being together as a grouping, it is easier to lobby government. And I'm interested to know how the lobby, because I mean the stuff the ban has been quite a big campaign, in the mass market for all of us individuals on the outside. I'm very interested to know if there is a lobbying that is being done in the formalized structure that you have, because I would assume you have a voice that can talk to government directly in various aspects, and how that is going.
Mm. Yeah, we've done a lot. In fact, before we can even start the hashtag lift the ban, and we engaged them in several meetings with them, and at some stage, they even said, okay, they lift the ban. The president said he'll lift the ban. All of a sudden, they changed. You know, we engaged them. It's not that we don't. We do. It's just that we don't have a people within EA who can listen to us and who understand our frustration and who are willing to help the farmers to grow from subsistence farming to a commercial farming. We don't have that. We engaged the minister with regards to that. Actually, it's not that we started after the ban. I mean, we started before the lockdown.
Yeah.
We're engaging the government because there are many restrictions when it comes to tobacco, which kills the smallholder farmers to grow into commercial. So there are many issues that are involved. That's why I said we had a myriad of challenges before we can even start to get into the industry, because the industry is there and people who are there in the industry are willing to assist us, but the government is putting a brake on it, which makes it very difficult for us to begin to grow and to be able to grow up to the stage where we'll call ourselves the commercial farmers.
Right. Well, Jabulani, all I can say to you is good luck, because I think most people in this country are all for small farmers. I don't know anyone who would like to see you guys fail. I'm sure that there are huge challenges ahead, and just know that you're not alone, and we're all with you in the hashtag lift the ban. And I hope that we get some reaction from government, because it's getting ridiculous now.
We appreciate it.
No, for sure.
We appreciate it. We would like everybody to come on board and help us, because really we need to do something about it. It's killing and it's destroying our families as well. We can't take our kids to school. You know, it's very difficult for us.
Well, I appreciate you being so honest with us this morning. And thank you, Jabulani. Best of luck to you. Godspeed.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Have a lovely day.
Yeah. Wow. There's Jabulani Tembe, who's working alongside the South African Tobacco Transformation Alliance. And he himself is the secretary of the Black Tobacco Farmers Association. Sure, Pumi. Can you imagine how horrible that is? You're looking at not being able to keep your business going. You're looking at not being able to send your kids to school. You're looking at having to lay off all your workers. And you've just managed to scrape together enough to keep your subsistence farm going, or to start making some commercial inroads. And then this comes along.
Yeah. It's affecting a lot of people, man.
So lift the ban. There is a petition. All you have to do is go along to lifttheban.org. I have, and you know, I'm not a smoker, so I don't have, I don't have a dog in this fight. Personally, I would prefer if my parents would stop smoking, but they're not going to. And I'm not going to be the one to try and change their behavior and their habits. I have my whole life. I've tried, and it's not going to happen. So there's no way Nkosi Sana Dlamini Zuma is going to change their mind. And all you have to do is go to lift the ban, because I don't think that we should be putting people like Jabulani out of work. I don't think we should be ruining his farm. I don't think we should be forcing his family to have to do unbelievably hard things in order to keep their lifestyle together. And you can go to lifttheban.org and join up. Hashtag lifttheban on social media. See if you can get some reaction from government. And if you are from government and you're listening to us now, I hope you heard what Jabulani said. I hope you feel at least a little bit of empathy for the man. You know, we always think tobacco, big tobacco, is this huge commercial machine, and that the people in it are these nefarious characters who sit in dark rooms and lobby government and have unbelievable power. And they may have, for all we know. But in this case, we spoke to a guy who's on the ground. He grows some tobacco. He can't make a living now. That's not some made-up story.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, man. What do you got in the agenda for today, Pums? How's school going with Kanego? Is he in? Is he out? What's the story?
So, the school situation, don't get me started. Everybody's having some kind of... Dude!
No, what is happening? Because I've got friends...
So there was the Cossas...
Yeah, well, these friends of mine are saying...
Or whatever he is.
Yeah. I heard he wants to stop people from having private schools open for their kids. Now, I've got a friend, and she said to me on a WhatsApp yesterday, it's on a group that we're all on, she said, look, I have understood a lot of the things around this lockdown. She's taken it very seriously. She has been teaching her kid at home for a long time. They send their kid to a little private school. He's only six. And she said, if COSAS threaten to shut down my child's school, she said, I'm a mom. I'm not a violent person, not aggressive. But if COSAS think they're going to get involved in my child's life and education, that's where you're going to see me turn into a monster. And I think that's probably true for a lot of moms.
What was the end result of the consultation around what a group of parents is called? Did we ever come to a consensus?
I don't know, but it's dangerous. I'll tell you what.
I'm going to be organizing. I will be among the first. I'll be like those freedom riders here. I will rile up my little WhatsApp group of parents because I don't.
It will be a station wagon, not really a bus, but I see what you're saying.
It'll be like a V, with that Mercedes-Benz V, V-class. My little tables in the inside. But I think, and this is why earlier we were talking about, for me, the great imagination that is required to lift us all out of these small moments.
Mm.
Those are the kinds of things that I'm ready for. I'm ready to get into that space of my imagination. I'm ready to use, because I think we've been taken advantage of by too many people for too long. But also we're going on school holiday on Friday.
Yeah, so you probably just last out the weekend and forget that we had this conversation.
Excuse me if I've asked you this before, but do you think that his education has been affected? And his actual learning, like how has he lost out on learning?
So, learning is a multidisciplinary, multisensory experience. It's not just the time you spend in front of your books. It's the time you spend with your friends. Mm-hmm. It's the time you spend in a class. It's all of those things put together. And so in some aspects, I feel that he has probably done better off. And I think I told you guys this before, that in my mind, when they started saying, we're going to be doing the homeschooling, knowing that I'm the world's worst teacher, I was happy to kind of look at his mark and adjust it and take an adjustment that says if there's a 10% knock in either direction, I'm going to be okay with that. Right?
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be him. It's going to be all of the stuff, the stresses, the this, the that.
Sure.
He loves the online stuff. He loves being able to work on his iPad or his laptop and not have to handwrite everything. He hates his handwriting. So that he's become a much more proficient individual with all of those technical aspects of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He's always been an independent person, but I think a lot of our kids have become much more independent because they realize that their parents are idiots when it comes to trying to teach them anything. So
they become
good at managing us.
Yeah.
And every conversation I have with a lot of my friends is around that, is how good our kids have become at managing up, which a lot of people need in the workplace as well. So that's a thing that they've learned. We all need to manage our bosses, right? We need to manage power in that way, and they've become better at doing that. But I think he's suffered in that he misses his friends, he can't see everybody, they can't play soccer, they can't. So that aspect is a little bit
right
gone down the toilet.
I
other than that,
Your point is not lost on me at all, but your language changed in the past couple of seconds. It sounded like my report card. He's not really proficient.
Because
10% going down was not as a result of the adjustment of managing and...
Yeah, I heard that too.
Even I have to become on the homeschool teacher.
Yes, it was very teacher-like, very school language. I'm like, oh, wow, we're talking about proficient. Actually, well, at 7:54 in the morning. Wow.
All I can say is, like, my kudos to parents who've had to put up with all of this craziness, because it is extraordinary and extraordinary times. And it's hard enough being a parent, but now you're also a school teacher and you have to worry about cosas and a whole lot of other things. So listen, parents, kudos to the kids.
I think in all of this, we started out the show complaining about how we feel and the Zoom calls and all of that stuff. I don't think any of us pay enough attention to how amazing the little people have been kind of readjusting to this. Imagine being a person that spent 80% of your time outside running, playing, chatting with friends, and all of that ripped out from underneath you. Now you're hanging out in the house with stressed out parents all the time. If you've got siblings and you rile each other up all the time, I mean, the kids are all right, guys. The kids are all right.
Okay, on that note, we're going to call it quits for today, but thank you for joining us. You know what to do. If you want to hear more, you can go along to cliffcentral.com and you can download all the podcasts, because we've got shows about just about everything. And we've got a new award-winning show, actually, which we didn't talk about last week, but we actually got a placement at the New York Festival Awards for our Babies Behind Bars series, which we really did.
Yeah.
We did like a pilot episode for that, but I've got to give Romy Titus all the credit here and Greg Cohen from Cliff Central. Two of them worked very hard behind the scenes to make it happen, and it is a just reward for all of their patience and their hard work for that series. And let me tell you, a very emotional, very moving series too. If you want to hear something that's just indescribably difficult, you know, it's the story of these moms who have kids either just before they go to jail or in jail. And these babies grow up behind bars. And then at 2 years old, they get taken away from their moms. Now you imagine all of that happening to you, not just as the kid or the mom, but what that feels like in that community, what it does to those women. And Romy's just exceptionally, she's so deep in it. She's empathetic and she knows the stories and she knows these women. And I'd advise you to take a listen to it. If you can go along to cliffcentral.com and you'll find it there. Also, while we're talking about things that are happening on cliffcentral.com, don't miss Mbulelo's sports show tonight. He's got a whole lot more. And through the course of this week, he'll be talking to inter alia James Dalton. He's spoken to a number of other people. And what is your overall plan here, Mbulelo? You're building a community.
We do. We want to build a community just as Cliff Central has done. We want to give people a look. I mean, if you're watching on your traditional platforms, you know what you're going to get from Sportsman, right? Platitudes, blah, blah, blah. He goes, he disappears. Like last night, who would have ever thought a World Cup rugby player is actually an accountant, a qualified business accountant? These are the sides you never see. He cares about being a father. These are the kinds of things we want to expose to people, that, especially for young sportsmen, is you can be a 360-degree human and also be a world-class sportsman. For me, that's really important. Lovely. As Cliff Central has always done, we're going to change the game.
Beautiful. Go along to cliffcentral.com and you can join in those conversations. Thanks very much for joining us this morning. Thank you, Pumi. Thank you, Mbulelo. And thank you, Sia. And most of all, thank you to you. We will see you tomorrow at 6, bright and early.
Cliffcentral.com.